The following program is intended for mature audiences.
Welcome to the Soul Mason Show!
Yes, indeed. Welcome to the Phil Mason Show. And wherever you are, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. You can catch the show at 5 p.m. daily on Max Sports Channels, at 10 p.m. daily on TalkSuperStation.com, and at various times throughout the day on Armed Forces Radio and Cosmic Radio. I'd like to welcome you to the Phil Mason Show. I have a great show planned for you today. Coming up later, Kevin Light from GrizzlyBearBlues.com will talk about the possibility of the running, gunning Memphis Grizzlies. And later on, Alex Hall will be here to talk Oakland A's baseball. But up first, from True Blue LA, please welcome their managing editor and my friend, Mr. Eric Steven, to the show. Eric, how you doing? Welcome back to the show. What's happening in Dodger land?
Doing well, Phil. Thanks a lot for having me, and I feel like I'm in the Truman Show with that intro, the good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. I like it.
I'm trying to modify it, as you know, because it's not like this global show, and I don't want to like offend people and say good evening when they're listening in the morning, or
sure. It's
been hot today when it's like snowing there. Yeah, it's a completely different one from what we're used to, that's for sure. Yasiel Puig. That's my guy. He's in a Puig of his own. Vin Scully refuses to say this, of course. He has his own thing, and I guess I have to let him. He was benched the other day, and Twitter went bananas, Facebook went bananas, and just about everyone else went bananas except for the Dodgers. What was that all about?
Yeah, they kind of took it in stride as a team, I think. They won. They did beat the Cubs 4-0. Yeah, Vin Scully likes to call Puig the wild stallion, and what was interesting is that it wasn't exactly pinned down why he was benched. Puig did say that it was for not being ready in the field. I think specifically what it was is like it's hard to see like on the replay, but either like not paying attention on a pitch or two while in right field on defense, or you know just sort of. Something in general on that, and there was an incident where he also didn't like necessarily run hard out to right field. I don't think it was that, but that may have contributed to it. But yeah, he was removed after 4 innings, and the second he's removed, you know, the first thought is always, okay, is he injured? And then that was sort of quickly ruled out because no trainers were like around him. He was in the dugout still. He seemed to be like pleading his case sort of with Nick Punto. So. At this point, all we knew was manager's decision, so it's clear he was benched for some reason. And that the problem was when you're benched after 4 innings, that leads about 5 innings or about you know an hour and a half to 2 hours of speculating. Things can build up without any knowledge at this point. So before anyone knew exactly what it was, there was so much talk about it that it already had become this big built-up thing. And you know, so. And then we found out after the game the reasoning and the, you know, Mattingly kept saying he tried to keep it in-house and didn't want to talk too much about it and that he put in Skip Schumacher because felt he gave us the best chance to win on that day, which, you know, on its face seems kind of funny because obviously, you know, Puig is a better player than Skip Schumacher, but I think at that time what Mattingly was referring to was his concentration level and, you know, just trying to send a message to him. And they had a long meeting with Puig after the game. I think everything's okay now. The plan is to start him again on Friday, Mattingly said. So it's not necessarily a long-term thing. It's just something they dealt with. And it's, you know, 22-year-old, first year in America, you know, let alone, you know, in Major League Baseball. So he's going through some things and I think the team is there. There's a lot of veterans on the team and they're all sort of in his corner and they talk to him at times to let him know, you know, the right way to do things like that. So yeah, I don't think it's as nearly as bad as people think, but it's just something he's just a learning curve that he's going through. That's all.
Yeah. And they talk, you know, the media talks a lot of crap about Puig missing cutoff men, for example. I mean, these are things that do they matter at the end of the day? I mean, this is a guy who as soon as he was brought up, brought a resurgence to basically a dead team, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of what gets lost in a lot of this sometimes is, you know, there were a lot of columns a little, like maybe 10 days ago or so, that were, you know, Puig is missing too many cutoff men. He's going to cost the Dodgers in the playoffs, and he should be benched because of that. And something like that, you know, it's not necessarily a reason to bench a guy. It's one thing if he's being, you know, especially stubborn and just making really dumb plays over and over again. He still does make, you know, bad throws to the wrong base, things like that. But most of those are, you know, like sort of effort-based mistakes. It's not that he's lollygagging or he's actually trying. He's just not doing it the right way. And I think what people miss in a lot of times is that even with those mistakes, his still contribution to the club is a net positive, because you take away. I think those are measurable. You know, you could see guys taking extra bases. You can sort of measure that. His mistakes on the bases, those are outs. You can measure that. And while those are negative things against Puig, he provides so much more positive value, you know, just in his hitting and his other base running, because he's technically, you know, a good base runner in terms of, you know, speed, stealing bases. He does get caught, and those will obviously count against him. But the overall net is a positive for the Dodgers, and it's not like they have, you know, a slew of players around that are better than him. So benching him is more, you know, necessarily hurting the team than it is hurting Puig if you're talking about like a long-term thing. But yeah, I think, you know, it's not really considered that they're going to bench him for any extended period of time. But people do lose sight of the fact that he's still a pretty big contributor on the team.
Yeah, and they lose fact that he wasn't even counted on in the spring. He was put there because they had no choice. And he's done everything they've asked him to do. And these things, these little things like, okay, he overruns bases sometimes, or he tries to stretch things out. Sometimes he doesn't hit the deck when he should at second on a double play wall. He misses cutoff men. This is what they do in the winter, right?
Yeah. And it's the things they work on, like Don Mattingly likes to say, you know, it's a teachable moment, that kind of, it's something they work on him with, so and it's something they'll continue to do so. The one thing I did sort of like about Wednesday was that, you know, there was some speculation. Puig has this sort of habit of, he kind of, I don't want to say nonchalant, but because he's always in the right position, but when he catches the ball in right, he has a habit of just sort of sticking his glove out on this, like sort of just right by the side of his head, and he catches it like right there. It's sort of a style thing. It looks kind of like he's barely, you know, trying or moving or something. But someone was asking Mattingly if he thought, you know, that was one of the reasons why he's benched. And he's like, no, I played with Ricky Henderson. He used to do that all the time. He'd give him 1,000 fly balls. He might miss one. So he's like, that's not even a big deal. So I thought that was kind of a funny little aside.
Yeah, I did too, because he's right. You know, guys have their own style of catching balls, and he doesn't drop too many. And Ricky Henderson used to do all kinds of things. Who was the one that used to swing at it like he was swiping at a fly outside?
That was Ricky.
That was Ricky. That's right. Yeah, he used to do all kinds of things like that.
Yeah,
always.
He had a style all his own.
Now, when you look at Yasiel Puig, and you've been following the Dodgers for most of your life, is he the biggest rookie impact player that you've seen?
It's a good question. I think, okay, so I was 5 when Fernando Valenzuela was a rookie in 1981. So I didn't really start following the team until maybe 3 years later. So if I was cognizant of the team around then, I would definitely say Fernando. But outside of him, I think the only one that would beat Puig, in my opinion, well, there's two. It's one, Mike Piazza, who just sort of obliterated all the, like, the team, like, rookie catching records. Hit 35 home runs his rookie year. And then Hideo Nomo. But, you know, obviously he's a different category because he was a he was a pitcher in Japan with professional experience, that kind of a thing. But he definitely was a Nomo did qualify as a mania, sort of like Fernando did. But I think Puig is on that level with those guys. And so, yeah, he's definitely had a huge, huge impact.
Well, I definitely remember Fernando Mania. I was, I guess, a sophomore in high school in 1981. And he was big news. Everybody wanted to see him on the game of the week, the way he used to pitch, the way he carried himself. But this Puig is different. And you know, the other guy I think about when I see him play is the other one, the other rookie that stands out in my mind is Raul Mondesi when he first came up.
Oh, definitely. He was in that run of Dodgers had like five straight rookies of the year. And just in terms of style, and, you know, they both are outfielders, both have great arms, both have power and speed. Yeah, Raul is definitely that. And I do think there's room for that comparison. And think, I think Puig has potential to sort of, you know, as good as Mondesi was, Puig has the potential to sort of, you know, really surpass him. But yeah, I think all the tools are definitely there. That you saw in Mondesi, Puig is like almost like a better version of that. And that's an exciting thing for Dodger fans.
Exactly, it is. So media, leave this guy alone, leave the little things alone, and just concentrate on the fact that this kid is in a Puig of his own, and it's a joy to watch him play. I love watching. Whenever I get a chance, Eric, as soon as I finish the show, I try to flip over the stream, at least catch a couple innings every night, because he's fantastic to watch. He's very exciting. What's more exciting to me is the dog days of summer. Here comes September. Big series this weekend with San Diego at home. Finishes up your homestand. Then it's off on the road, Colorado 3 games, and then Cincinnati 3 games. Is this a big road trip?
I don't want to say big. It's weird. The Dodgers have, I want to say, you know what, about 5 weeks left. There's only 29 games left on the schedule, and for the Dodgers, only 10 of those are against teams that have a winning record. The 3 games in Cincinnati that you mentioned, and then they play the Diamondbacks, who are their, you know, their chief rivals right now in the West. They play them 7 times. You know, the Dodgers do have a big lead right now. It's 9.5 games. So, you know, I don't want to say, you know, it's like I've already, at one point I declared the Dodgers season over, so I don't want to already claim that they're going to win the division again so early, but it's looking like they're going to probably win the division. But they're still in the hunt for, like, you know, playoff seeding, possibly still best record. They're 2.5 games behind the Braves. So I think there's still room for them to, you know, still grow and still make a move. And I think they have playing a lot of teams that they can do some damage against. So I do think they have that opportunity in front of them. They play the Padres, the Rockies. They should be able to win all of those series, even the one in Cincinnati. So, especially, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think Greinke and Kershaw both pitch in that Cincinnati series. So that's always a good thing that it's lined up perfectly for the Dodgers in that case. And so I do think they have an opportunity to make another move here.
I think you're right. You know, when we talk about the pitching staff, Hyun-Jun Ryu, he's, you know, there's a guy right there who's been pretty much overlooked in the general scheme of things. He could very well, if it wasn't for Puig going crazy, he could very easily be the Rookie of the Year, couldn't he?
Yeah, this year has been one of the best, like, Rookie of the Year seasons I can remember. You know, you don't have this many impact guys usually, and that, you know, not only Puig and Ryu, but Jose Fernandez and the Marlins. I think Puig's a favorite, but Jose Fernandez is having an incredible year for the Marlins, like top, you know, possibly top five, like Cy Young type of year. So if Puig doesn't win it, it's going to be Fernandez, but Ryu's going to slot in probably at third. But I think there's still time for sort of Ryu to, to make a run. And, yeah, he's been great. It's funny, the Dodgers also, like in another year, Paco Rodriguez has been so effective out of the bullpen. He's technically a rookie too, so they're actually getting a lot of contributions from, you know, rookies this year, which is funny to say on such a veteran team. But yeah, it's been a great, great year for rookies, and the Dodgers are sort of leading the pack in that regard.
Yes, they are. They definitely are. You know, that Cincinnati series, though, that might be tough, because even though you've got your two aces out there, those guys are fighting for the division. So who knows what's going to happen? This I like this Arizona. You've got seven games with Arizona. That's a big rivalry. What do you see happening with that Arizona mess? Out of seven, you think you should win five, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard. You know, it's hard to sort of predict it, especially a couple weeks in advance. But I would say, you know, what Arizona has to do, since they're so far back, is they almost have to sweep. And like, if they don't win six of the seven at the very minimum, they're probably not going to be able to catch the Dodgers unless they make some incredible run. So I think what the Dodgers just have to do is try to, you know, it's always a cliche, but you try to win each series and that kind of thing. So they have a four-game series there and a three-game series at home. So you try to split on the road, win at home, win four of the seven, and I think that'll be enough to sort of hold them at bay even, no matter what they do. So I think that's what the Dodgers are probably looking to do. But you never know. They even have a more hyper focus than that. So a lot of times they just try to win every single day, and they just focus on that day. I know it's cliche, but I just saw the team that I thought was dead go 42-8 over 50 games. So I'm not gonna count them out of winning any amount of games. So it's pretty funny.
Yeah, after I counted them out and wrote their obituary on this show with Steve Goldman, they did go crazy. Is it possible for them to win 100 games?
Yes. It's like you said, you know, it's one of these where I don't know if it's likely. They're 78-55 right as we record this, so they'd have to go 22-7. And 22-7 sounds a lot more doable now than it did, you know, than say a month ago. So when it was even ridiculous, I believe they're 21-6 in August, and that was after they were, they had a great month of July. So I think they were 19-6 in July or something like that. So what they have is, an opportunity here to win 100 games, but which I never would have thought possible. Even when they were, down, and you think you just want them to try to get 90 wins, and then now, it would almost be a disappointment if they just finished with 90. So they're looking like at least a 95 win team, I think. But 100 is definitely within the realm of possibility, and they have a decent shot at catching the Braves and possibly like having the best record in baseball, which would be amazing for a team that was 12 games under 500 at one point.
Exactly, it would, and they have a cupcake of a September to do just that. Eric, thank you so much for being on the show. Great stuff as always. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Phil. Always my pleasure.
Hey, thank you. That was Eric Steven. You can find him over at TrueBlueLA.com. Coming up next, Kevin Leip will be here to talk about the possibility of the running, gunning Memphis Grizzlies. And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
Music 24/7 on CosmicRadio.com. CosmicRadio.com.
Been dreaming of that Greek vacation? Well, if you have, then you might want to check out the folks at the Aridi Grand Hotel, located in beautiful Corfu, Greece. Come experience world-class cuisine as well as the hospitality that Greece is legendary for at the Aridi Grand Hotel. You can find them at aridihotel.com or email them at reservations@aridihotel.com.
TalkSuperStation.com.
That's right, the superstation of talk.
Talking to you each and every day.
We have a lot to talk about.
Monday.
Government is not the answer. Health is the answer.
Hey guys, I'm here.
Tuesday.
The Yankees are always good.
We're going to go for old-timers
now. Well, I think I feel. I'm a Mets fan. They have clothespin.
Wednesday.
You and I are staying put.
Thank goodness, because I have no socks on, and staying put is what I need to do.
Thursday.
I would love Martin Sheen actually decided to run for president, I would vote for him.
Friday.
You know how hard it is to get a topic not about sports on ESPN Radio? It's about as hard as me introducing sports on this show.
Saturday.
It's time to party.
And Sunday.
How can we respect anyone in Washington, D.C.?
Every day, we talk to you.
Sit back and enjoy this.
Talk Superstation.
I'm on the air.
.com. Talk. Spoken here.
Are you tired of boring sports websites that's about the same old company line? If you are, then I'd invite you to stop over to thesportsgoons.com. The Reggie commentary and a weekly podcast highlighting today's issues is second to none. That's thesportsgoons.com. The new media has arrived.
Stitcher Smart Radio is an award-winning, free mobile application that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. Now you don't even need a Wi-Fi or a cell connection to listen to shows like The Phil Nason Show. Never miss another show. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com and download the free app today. And never miss another Phil Nason Show.
This Week in Tennis is a weekly tennis program covering all aspects of professional tennis. The most controversial tennis show anywhere deals with issues no one seems to want to touch. For music and hard-hitting commentary, please visit philnasons.com.
Hi, this is Phil Nasons from This Week in Tennis and The Phil Nason Show. Max Sports Channels offers the best in sports talk radio, as well as great music 24 hours a day. It's my daily destination, and I hope it's yours. The sports talk begins each and every day at 3 p.m. and ends around 9 p.m. Special programming on the weekends. And in between all that, the hottest music on the internet. That's Max Sports Channels. Make it your daily destination.
Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. And we are joined, as always, every Friday by GrizzlyBearBlues.com managing editor Kevin Light to talk about the Memphis Grizzlies, the run-and-gunning Grizzlies. Kevin, what do you think about the run-and-gunning Grizzlies? Is that like hyperbole?
Yeah, I think that might be a little overselling it. But I'm good. I'm good. It's good to be back. You know, I think that there is a kind of a lot of talk going around about the run-and-gun Grizzlies, huh? I still just don't know how such a post-oriented team is gonna transition overnight into this fast-paced kind of thing. I still think so much of it just depends on getting into sets earlier, but not necessarily. You hear run and gun, and you think, you think about a team like the Rockets that just gets out in transition and gets out in transition and gets out in transition. I think this Grizzlies team is just constructed in such a way that they're going to have to do half court set stuff. They're just going to have to get into their sets a lot more quickly. I'll believe the run and gun when I see it.
Yeah, I don't see how they're going to do it either. But picking up the pace a bit and getting into their set quicker is something that probably would benefit them, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They were one of the slowest teams in the league in terms of pace stats last year. And a lot of that is Mike Conley dribbling at the top of the key while the post guys get to their spots. So I think Mark and Zebo are going to have to get into position quicker so that the offense can kind of initiate with 18 seconds on the shot clock still instead of, 12. You're going to get more shots at the basket before the shot clock expires that way. And you have to generate more possessions.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I like the transition with Conley bringing it up on the fast break and Tony Allen and Tayshaun Prince on the wings. I like that.
Yeah.
But the whole thing for me is how long is it going to take Randolph and Gasol to get down the floor?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, neither one of them is the most athletic guy. Zebo's even slower than Mark. It's just you're never going to be that like super fast transition kind of team as long as those are your post guys, which is fine. That's just not what they're good at. They're certainly excellent at other things. I would hate to see the Grizzlies kind of try to be something that they're just not built to be. And, you know, even if you take Zebo out of the equation, I guess, you know, Ed Davis is a little more athletic, can run a little bit more. But you still got Marc Gasol out there, and he's not flying down the floor. I don't know. I don't see them kind of transitioning into a transition team overnight like that.
Well, I don't think so either, but Kosta Kufis can run the floor, and it kind of takes away his limitations of his post-up game. So that could help. You know, what I'm thinking is that they could run the gun when they have Kufis and Davis on the floor with Prince or Poindexter, even Tony Allen, Mike Conley, or even Nick Calates, and then just bury teams at the end with Zebo and Gasol and just ground and pound like they usually do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's if that is what's going to happen, that's got to be what it's going to look like, because you can run Kufis and Davis out there. You know, Poindexter can just run for one corner or the other corner. Tony Allen is such a good, you know, he's so good at like just slashing to the rim. He may not make the layup once he gets there, but he's really good at getting there. And you know, Mike Conley is Mike Conley. We know what his skill set is at this point. You know, it kind of brings me back to a lot of the talk kind of right around the Western Conference Finals was about how Tony Parker is a player that Mike Conley could learn from and could stand to pattern himself after. I think this sort of transition into the Grizzlies kind of picking up the pace and being a little bit more, I guess, deliberate about the kind of offensive sets that they're running and a little more mindful of the plays that they're running instead of just kind of, oh yeah, Zebo post up. I think that Mike Conley kind of turning himself into this Tony Parker kind of pick and roll ball handler, just, you know, that sort of Tony Parker floater in the lane distributor can also score role for him. I think those two things kind of go hand in hand.
I agree with you. You know, when people mention Tony Allen, they talk about the fact that he doesn't always make his layups, but he still shoots 52% from around the rim, which is close to, or if not above, league average. So, I mean, he's not that bad.
No, he's not that bad. He just, it seems like the layups that he does miss seem to be the easiest ones. To somebody like you or me, the wide open fast break layup that he misses, he gets a bad rap, but really, he makes the offense better when he's on the floor, than it would be with some, you know, scrub out there, because he's a good slasher. He's really good at slashing and cutting, and he seems to always score 12 points in the first quarter. I don't know how he does that. And then his jump shot just turns off about 8 minutes into the basketball game.
But that's okay, because Mike Miller can come in at that point.
Exactly.
And Miller can shoot. Now, Mike Miller would also benefit from a faster pace as well, wouldn't he? Because he'll get open quicker. He'll get his chance to pop. and shoot, shoot, shoot. That's what the Grizzlies need to see, right?
Yeah, and I think you could have some lineups where you have Pondexter and Miller on the floor at the same time. If you're running a fast break and you run one of them to each corner, I mean, neither you can't leave either one of them in the corner.
Nope. And you know what? I saw some ridiculous stuff out there, too, about the Grizzlies perhaps playing small ball. And I'm going, did you look at their roster? Have you ever seen them play? This team is not going to play small ball, is it?
Well, you know, they did actually play Tayshaun Prince at the four a little bit, kind of towards the end of last season. Especially you saw it against the Clippers a little bit. And it actually worked. I really wouldn't be surprised if you see them just kind of throw that lineup out from time to time. It's obviously not going to be their bread and butter kind of main go-to look, but they definitely are capable.
Okay. I stand corrected then. I like that. But
I really wouldn't be surprised. It's kind of one of those things where it just depends on the matchup and it depends on who they're playing and who's on the floor at any given time. It's certainly they're not a team like maybe the Thunder, where they kind of have small ball as one of their go-to looks that they like to throw out there. But I definitely think they're capable of doing it if they need to, or if Coach Yeager thinks that that's going to be an advantageous matchup for them.
Yeah, and it all depends, too, on what happens with Zach Randolph and what they do with him. Ultimately, I don't know if you're going to see him finish the season, and if he doesn't, if they find another small forward, this could be a real small ball team, right?
Yeah, yeah, and you just leave Gasol out there as a center and put three shooting guard, small forward types around him. Your options are limitless at that point. The Randolph question, I think, is going to be kind of the determining factor of this season. It's going to color everything that happens from here on out. Is he going to be here? Is he going to stay? Are they going to trade him? Who are they going to get? What's his contract? I mean, that is to me, even more so than how's Dave Yeager going to do in his first year, I think the Zebo story is the story of this season.
I think it will be, and we'll be talking about that all season, I'm sure, until they finally do whatever they decide to do. But the run-and-gun-and Grizz, I don't know, man. It could be interesting at times, but like I said earlier, I'd love to see them bust out, open up a decent lead, and just let the big boys pound them in the fourth quarter and finish the job.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they've hung their hat on for so long. That identity is not going to be able to, you're not going to be able to get rid of that overnight. I certainly think they're going to be a little bit more intentional about the offense that they're running. Henry Bibby was Lionel Hollins' main X's and O's guys, and he's just kind of known for being really conservative. Nothing really innovative that they were doing on offense. And Dave Yeager is just not that type of a coach. So the offense is clearly going to be different. We don't really know how it's going to be different, what it's going to look like. And we won't know until we see him in training camp or preseason. I was actually kind of working on an outline for a piece earlier today, kind of just listing all the things that we don't know about the Grizzlies right now. We don't know what the offense is going to look like. We don't know if Zach Randolph is going to be here all year. We don't know what they're going to do with all these trade exceptions. We don't know if they're still trying to trade Tayshaun Prince and what they're going to do with Bayless. We don't know how Kolathis is going to play. There's a lot of question marks with this team that we just don't have any answers to yet. I really think that, for somebody who spends a whole lot of time thinking and talking about the Grizzlies, I don't have a lot of answers. I don't think anybody does.
No, I sure don't. All we can do is speculate. That's it. It should be an interesting season, though. No question about that.
Oh yeah, the storylines are already built into it. I just named some. There are a lot more than that.
Yeah, how will Dave Yeager actually coach? It's a big transition from assistant coach to head coach.
For sure.
Especially replacing a very successful coach in Lionel Hollins. And I guess for the most part, Hollins was quite popular, right?
Yeah. Pretty much everybody except the few media members who he kind of rubbed the wrong way. He was really well liked around town. And, you know, winning does that.
It most certainly does. Now, we have, and that ought to be interesting to see the running gun and Grizzlies, how that matches up and how it shakes out. But we got a question, Kevin. We've got about 2.5 minutes, and that's probably all we'll need for this one. Now, I believe this was hypothetical, of course, but the listener wanted to know about Ersan Ilyasova, and it goes like this. Ersan Ilyasova is available. Which Grizzlies would you trade him for? What would you trade him for? Would you even go after a guy like Ilyasova?
I think he would be a good... I think he could be a good subject of that Bayless and Tayshaun Prince trade. You know?
Yeah, he would be.
If they were able to move two players like that and get a guy like Ilyasova, he's only, what, 25, 26? You know, he can shoot the ball. He's a good player. You know, you see kind of him and Gasol on the floor at the same time. That would be an interesting kind of thing. I don't really think you could play him and Randolph at the same time, though. I'm not really sure, unless you were playing Ilyasova at the three, which I guess you could.
Yeah, you could do that.
You know, I definitely think that I don't think the Bucks would ever make that trade, but I think that if there were a way to kind of to swing the get out from under Tayshaun Prince's contract, you know, maybe get Bayless out of here, because I don't think they thought he was going to pick up his player option for this year to begin with. Get a guy like that back, you know, that's another good player, another good piece. That I think if you use him correctly, take advantage of his shooting, his kind of floor spacing abilities, you know, he's a good player. He could really benefit the Grizzlies if they were able to make a move and get him.
Yeah, he shot, what, 44% from beyond the arc? And
46% the year before that.
Yeah, and 46% from the field. That's not bad.
No.
Now, his rebounding, he rebounds every year. He's gotten better at rebounding. His offensive rebounds were a little down, but then Milwaukee was the Rucker Park Street legend, so what can you do about that? But that would be an interesting trade. I would do that, too. I would take Poindexter or someone like that and Tayshaun Prince. That's what it would take to get him.
But, yeah, it would.
That would be a good trade, and it would be good for the Grizzlies. But then again, we would spend another 16 minutes speculating on how he would fit into the new run and gun Grizzlies.
Exactly. You know, I don't think they would get rid of a guy like Poindexter. I think they just like him too much. I think this is Poindexter's year to really assert himself as a key Grizzly player. I don't think they would get rid of Poindexter this year. I think it would have to be Bayless.
Or it could be even Zach Randolph.
Yeah, there is that.
Because the Milwaukee Bucks, they do crazy things. Anyway, Kevin, great stuff tonight. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, anytime.
All right, that was Kevin Lipin. You can find him at grizzlybearblues.com. Coming up next, Alex Hall from Athletics Nation. We'll talk about the 3 out of 4 wins against Detroit in Detroit and a whole bunch more Oakland A's baseball. And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
Music 24/7 on CosmicRadio.com.
CosmicRadio.com.
Been dreaming of that Greek vacation? Well, if you have, then you might want to check out the folks at the Origi Grand Hotel, located in beautiful Corfu, Greece. Come experience world-class cuisine as well as the hospitality that Greece is legendary for at the Origi Grand Hotel. You can find them at OrigiHotel.com or email them at reservations@OrigiHotel.com.
TalkSuperstation.com.
That's right, the superstation of talk.
Talking to you each and every day.
We have a lot to talk about.
Monday.
Government is not the answer. Health is the answer.
Hey, guys, I'm here.
Tuesday.
The Yankees are always good.
We are going to go for old-timers now.
Well, I think I feel. I'm a Mets fan. We have clothespin.
Wednesday.
You and I are staying put.
Thank goodness, because I have no socks on, and staying put is what I need to do.
Thursday.
I would love Martin Sheen actually decided to run for president. I would vote for him.
Friday.
You know how hard it is to get a topic not about sports on ESPN Radio? It's about as hard as me introducing sports on this show.
Saturday.
It's time to party.
And Sunday.
How can we respect anyone in Washington, D.C.?
Every day, we talk to you.
Sit back and enjoy this.
Talk Superstation.
I'm on the air.
.com. Talk. Spoken here.
Are you tired of boring sports websites that's about the same old company line? If you are, then I'd invite you to stop over to thesportsgoons.com. The Reggie commentary and a weekly podcast highlighting today's issues is second to none. That's thesportsgoons.com. The new media has arrived.
Stitcher Smart Radio is an award-winning, free mobile application that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. Now you don't even need a Wi-Fi or a cell connection to listen to shows like The Phil Nason Show. Never miss another show. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com and download the free app today. And never miss another Phil Nason Show.
This Week in Tennis is a weekly tennis program covering all aspects of professional tennis. The most controversial tennis show anywhere deals with issues no one seems to want to touch. For music and hard-hitting commentary, please visit philnasons.com.
Hi, this is Phil Nasons from This Week in Tennis and The Phil Nasons Show. Max Sports Channels offers the best in sports talk radio, as well as great music 24 hours a day. It's my daily destination, and I hope it's yours. The sports talk begins each and every day at 3 p.m. and ends around 9 p.m. Special programming on the weekends, and in between all that, the hottest music on the internet. That's Max Sports Channels. Make it your daily destination.
Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show, and we are wrapping things up on an amazing week of sports talk radio. And joining me on the line from AthleticsNation.com, please welcome lead writer Mr. Alex Hall to the show. Alex, 3 out of 4 in Detroit, not too shabby.
In Moss we trust.
Sounds good.
It was a better road trip than I was expecting. The way the A's were playing, heading into Baltimore and Detroit to face two other contending teams, was a bit of a tall order, and I was not very optimistic about it last week, but it went very well. The part in Baltimore, not so much. They dropped 2 of 3. But in Detroit, they came 1 out away from a 4-game sweep on the road against arguably the best team in the American League. Like I say, we came 1 out away because in that 4th game, there was a 3-run lead entering the 9th, and the, you know, all-star closer Grant Balfour just fell apart and ends up giving a walk-off 3-run homer to Torrey Hunter. But we're going to focus on the good part, and that was the other 3.9 games leading up to that horrible 9th inning. The star of the series, without a doubt, was Brandon Moss. He's actually normally the first baseman for the team, but with Josh Reddick going on the disabled list, Moss has been covering him in right field, with Derek Barton rejoining the team to take first base. Moss was an outfielder for his whole career. He never actually really was playing first until he got to the A's last year. Just kind of squeezed in there because it was the only place there was space. So now he's back. He can absolutely hold his own in the outfield. He's got a pretty solid arm. But what he did this week was at the plate. He went 7-for-14 in these four games. He hit four home runs and a double, plus another four walks. He drove in 10 runs, and that was just in the last three games he drove in the 10 runs. That's a heck of a series. He's a guy who can get hot for certain stretches and just go absolutely nuts, just like Coco Crisp has done a couple of times. Kind of reminds me of Jack Cust from several years ago. I'm going to get blasted for that on Athletics Nation. But he was a guy who could suddenly hit six or seven homers in a week and just go absolutely bonkers. And that's what Moss just did. So with this week now in the books, he's got his batting average up over 250 for the season. He's slugging over 500 for the season. He set a new career high and counting with 25 homers so far. Remember, this is Moss's first full season in the majors. Even last year, he only played about a half a season. We've never seen what he can do in a full year. And there were doubts heading into this season if he might be a fluke based on what he did last year, if maybe he just showed up and took the league by storm and they didn't have time to adjust to him, especially in his platoon role last year. But he's been playing mostly full-time this year, and I got to say he's quieted the critics so far. Like I say, he's got the average into a respectable territory. He's still slugging 500, and he's having a fantastic season. But, man, did he just help. I want to say he carried the team this week, but he really didn't because the entire team was just on fire. The whole lineup, top to bottom, really came through. Another guy playing very well, Alberto Callaspo, the new acquisition. 25 games he's played since he joined the team. He's hitting .306. His on-base is nearly .400. He's hit a handful of doubles and a homer. He's been hitting very well, which is good because he wasn't necessarily brought here for his defense, just the fact that he could hold his own at second base. So he needed to hit well to be valuable to the team, and he's doing just that. So it's nice to see that lineup contributing top to bottom, especially considering who they were facing. And that was, I said the Tigers were arguably the best team in the league. Well, they are unarguably the best starting rotation in baseball. The A's had to face Anibal Sanchez, leading the league in ERA, Justin Verlander, obviously superstar, recent Cy Young winner, Doug Fister, another fantastic pitcher, and Max Scherzer, who is the Cy Young frontrunner so far this year. Whether you like his 19-1 record or all of his other stats, his low ERA, his high strikeouts and low walks and low hits and low homers, he's absolutely good at everything you could hope a pitcher would be good at. And the A's went up against those four pitchers, knocked each of them out after five innings, and scored 22 runs. 19 of those runs were earned in 20 innings combined off of those four pitchers. That is impressive. That is not a struggling lineup. That's a lineup that's turned a corner, figured some stuff out, and just destroyed the best starting rotation in baseball in that rotation's home. I wanted the sweep, but taking 3 out of 4 in that fashion, that makes me very optimistic for the last month of the season and for the rest of this stretch drive. If they can do anything like that against, say, the Rangers pitchers maybe, this team is going to be in great shape.
Yeah, I think you're right. That is a murderer's row up in Detroit, and a lot of runs were scored, though, right? In that series between two teams, right?
Yeah, a lot of runs were scored by the A's. A decent amount of runs were scored by the Tigers. I think it was 8-6 was the first game, and the A's had that, 14-4 win. This last one was 7-6. So, yeah, they were pretty high-scoring games. The other game, only 6-3, but remember, it was shortened in the sixth inning by rain, so that was 6-3 and a little over half a game. So you're right, it was a very high-scoring series on both sides, just luckily a lot more high-scoring on the A side. But, I mean, what do they do? They went up against two contending teams, and they came out the other side with a winning record on the road trip. I mean, I couldn't ask for anything more than that.
Nor should you. Now you've got this great homestand. You've got, 10-game homestand. You've got Tampa Bay this weekend. Texas is in town for 3 beginning on Monday.
And then next weekend, you've got four at home with Houston. This is going to get dicey. You've got 6 of the 10 games remain, or the 6 of the 10 in this homestand are with teams above 500 records. This is going to be a good little test for who the Oakland A's are. Am I wrong?
It is. And, you know, if you'd asked me a week or two ago, I would have been worried. But seeing the way that the A's just played, I'm excited because the two teams they're playing next are the teams they need to play. Looking at where the A's are in the standings, they currently hold the second wild card. They've got a 3.5 game cushion over Cleveland for that spot. But the team with the first wild card is the Rays, and they're only a game or two ahead of Oakland. And then you've got, you know, the AL West, where you've got the A's 3 games back of Texas entering Friday. So what more could you ask for than head-to-head matchups against both of those teams at your house? You get a chance to beat Tampa in a series and maybe tie or even take over that first wild card, and you've got a chance to play the Rangers head-to-head. Hey, if you sweep the Rangers, you might find yourself tied for the division by the beginning of next week, or by the end of next week. So this is one where you can take two routes here. You can say, boy, that's a rough time playing those two winning teams, or you can look and say, this is the opportunity of the season right here for the A's to make their move. Yeah, they've got the soft September against a lot of Twins and Astros and Mariners, but this is the chance right here, because you can beat the Twins all you want, but if the Rays and the Rangers win their games the same day, you're not going to gain any ground. This is your shot to play those teams head-to-head and decide this playoff picture a lot earlier than you could otherwise. If the A's can take care of business here and play like they just did, and they're going to have to face some tough pitchers like David Price, Yu Darvish, Alex Cobb always gives them problems with Tampa Bay. This is their chance to show this series was not a fluke against the Tigers and really make their move. And there's a couple of things that are going to help them with that, and they're mostly some players that are now on the roster that weren't last week, starting with Bartolo Colon. He went on the DL for a couple of weeks for a groin strain. Well, you know, you can look at that as a bad thing and say you lost Colon for a while, or you can look and you say, you know, Colon was struggling a little bit. He was off. He was walking guys. He was getting hammered. And you have to wonder if he was wearing down a little bit. He's getting up there in years. You know, he's not getting the benefit of whatever he was taking maybe the last year or two. I don't know what kind of difference that made. But every year it's going to be tougher and tougher for him to last the whole season. And he just got a two-week rest for his arm that clearly made a very big difference, because he came out, he wasn't like, he didn't throw a no-hitter or anything, but he threw 5 good innings, didn't walk anybody. That was huge to see him not walk anybody again. And, you know, he looked good. Then you've also got Brett Anderson. We've been missing him all season. He went out at the end of April with a foot problem. He rehabbed his way back up. They have put him in the bullpen for now because they don't think he's ready to start just yet. They wanted him on the team now, even though he wasn't stretched out and ready to go in the rotation. And they got the perfect chance to bring him in that blowout 14-4 game. He got to throw a few innings. The first two were lights out, fantastic. The last one, he had a little problem, gave up a few hits and a few runs. But the point is, he got out there. He was throwing hard. I think he hit 95 at some point. Everything looked right. And, you know, you can't look at the results every time when you're looking at a guy returning from injury, because the more important thing than the result is the method of how they got there. And Anderson looked good in that game. He had a couple of strikeouts. He had his velocity. And hopefully it's just a matter of stretching him out so he can throw 5 or 6 or 7 innings and get back in that rotation, because, man, he's supposed to be the number one or number two starter on this team. And if you add him back into the equation on a team that's been in first or second place all year without him, I mean, that's like acquiring, you know, a Peavy or a Garza. But you didn't have to trade anyone. He was just sitting on the DL. So there's your midseason acquisition, is Brett Anderson coming back from the DL. They also picked up a new or an old hitter, depending on how you look at it, reacquiring Kurt Suzuki from the Washington Nationals. They needed a catcher with John Jaso and Derek Norris on the DL. They were down to just Stephen Vogt, and he's already a minor league replacement. So they went out and got a major league catcher, and I got to say, he's not a world beater that's going to carry him to the playoffs, but I think he was the perfect acquisition for this team at this moment right now, because he's a major league catcher. He's not a minor league fill-in that's got to learn the ropes, and he's already familiar with virtually every one of the A's pitchers. And in the middle of the stretch run, when there's not a lot of margin for error, it's nice to know the catcher can step back into that starting rotation without missing a beat, without the learning curve, without meeting a bunch of new guys and learning new pitches. He already knows all these pitchers well enough that he can get right down in there and get down to business, and the pitchers are going to continue along like nothing changed. If anything, he's known as a fantastic game caller and defender. Pitchers could get even better with him behind the plate. So, yeah, he's not that much of a hitter, even though he's already had a couple of big hits for Oakland so far. He's not that much of a hitter, but I got to say, he was the perfect acquisition right now. I am very excited to have Suzuki back. He's a big fan favorite in Oakland. I know everybody's happy to have him back. And I'm happy because I still have an old Suzuki jersey from a jersey giveaway day at the Coliseum, and now I won't look like a fool when I wear it anymore because he's on the A's again. So welcome back, Kurt Suzuki. Everybody's excited to have him back. With Suzuki and Barton and Anderson on the team again, it's starting to look dangerously like, you know, maybe 2011, but we'll ignore that because all three of them look like they're ready to play well down the stretch.
And they're going to need to, too. Josh Reddick is out probably for the rest of the regular season, right?
At this point, you have to assume so. I mean, even if he comes back, can you trust him? Because that wrist has lingered all season long. It's ruined his whole year because he never let it get better. And so what, you bring him back in 2 weeks, maybe, but then is he going to be better yet? Or is he going to stink it up for the rest of the season? You might have to just leave him out and wait till next year and say, hey, take a mulligan, come back in 2014, rested and healed, and let's see if you can be that 20-30 homer power hitter again with your gold glove defense.
Yeah, we hope for the best for him because, man, this has been a bummer for him this season. I can't believe how long that injury has persisted. Can you?
I mean, it seems unbelievable, but that's what happens when you don't let it heal before you get back on the field. So, yeah, it seems weird, but is it that weird? Looking at the small amounts of time he took off each time, there was never that three-month span where he just let that get better. And we're talking about you know, one of his wrists here. That's big for a hitter. It's big for a fielder. Diving around, making throws all over the place. It's something that really needs to get taken care of. It needed to be taken care of in May and June, and he just came back too soon. It's unfortunate. Nothing you can do about it now except hope that it doesn't come back to bite you. But with Moss able to cover in right field now and do so at least adequately, if not better, they've thrown Derek Barton at first. You've still got Nate Freiman to play there. You've got a couple options in the minors with Michael Taylor and Michael Choice. Maybe one of them can force their way into the lineup as a little spark plug in September, get Moss back to first. There are options, but yeah, I'm a huge Reddick fan, and I'm disappointed that he's not going to be much of a factor for the rest of the season. I look forward to seeing him, shock everyone in the national media and come back good next year.
I think he'll be back in time for the playoffs. But this is going to be an amazing weekend of baseball with Toronto, or with Tampa Bay at home. Parker and Price open up on Friday. Sonny Gray takes the hill against Alex Cobb on Saturday. And A.J. Griffin takes on Roberto Hernandez on Sunday. And then three more right off the bat. Straley and Holland in the Texas series. Colon and Perez and Parker Darvish. This is going to be a lot of fun. What do you think is going to happen with these six games? Give us a prediction.
You know what? I spent half of the day sulking about that horrible blown game, but I'm feeling cocky now. I'm going to say 4 out of 6. We're going to take 2 out of 3 from each of these teams. A's are making their move right now. This is their time. They're going for it. 4 out of 6.
4 out of 6 is a pretty good prediction. I think I'm going to say 3 and 3. They're going to need to, but I think they're going to take 2 or 3 from Texas. I honestly think they need to. Otherwise, man, it's going to be tough. You don't want to win that wild card. You want to win the West. Anyway, great stuff tonight, Alex. Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Phil.
All right, that was Alex Hall. You can find him over at athleticsnation.com. And that's going to wrap it up for today's Phil Nason Show. I want to thank all my guests, Eric Steven, Kevin Life, and Alex Hall for making this an amazing finish to a great week. On Monday, Steve Goldman and I will be here talking American League Baseball, and it should be fun. We'll also be talking about Matt Harvey, pitch counts, and are these pitchers really being babied, and how are they being served in the minor leagues? Until then, you all take care of yourselves. Be good, And most importantly, thanks for listening. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you.